In this case, I don't know if you've ever, has anybody ever had a history class before? Anybody? Do you remember those? Okay. And your favorite thing, I'm sure, when you started a history class was the timelines, right? Thanks for a timeline because I'm not going to remember these dates. But we are actually going to start a timeline because normally when we read about the life of Paul, we're reading a letter that he's written and we're reading snippets of comments that he has about his life. But it's interesting to see kind of his life folded out in a timeline sequence. Now, I will tell you this. We don't have any, like, an autobiography by Paul. We have snippets of his information, but we don't have an autobiography. So that means our dates are going to be what? Sort of ish. Do you all know ish? I think it's a new word. I don't know if Webster's adapted that yet. But so we're going to be sort of ish with the exact dates on these things. We don't know his birthday. So let's dive in to a timeline. So we're looking at AD 6 as far as his birth year. And it talks about him being a Roman citizen. Does that mean anything? Does citizenship mean anything? Oh, yes. Have any of you ever traveled to another country? And they ask you about your citizenship. Yes. Yes, ma'am. Exactly. So that's, you know, you can have in this... Is that technically dual citizenship? You have two citizenships. So it means something, and it means, and of course that's, but in this case, it meant a lot to be a Roman citizen. And we'll talk about this more later on when we get to where that really he really used his citizenship in a certain instance. But that afforded Paul a lot of things that other people did not have. Talked about his being born in Tarsus, but raised in Jerusalem. Studies, when we talk about studying the Torah, what are we talking about? Yeah, the Old Testament and studying the Jewish law, and also not just studying the law. When the lawyer came to Jesus and tested Jesus with a question, you remember that on one occasion? What's the greatest commandment? And Jesus asked him two questions. What does the Bible say, and how do you read it? How do you read it? We all have the same book, right? I mean, you may have a different version, right? But we all have the same book. But do people read it differently? Is that? Okay. So those are two very important questions. So when he studied the Torah, when he studied not only the text, but he studied a certain particular way of interpreting this text. And he studied with Gamaliel, which he'll come up later on. As a Pharisee, and we'll talk more about what that means when we start talking about his little snippet of autobiography that he's given us. We know this about him, right? We know he did this. We know he persecuted the church, and we'll see his change this morning as he changes his... Some information comes to light and helps him to change his mind. And here's where we see this in AD 33, 36, again-ish, when this might have happened. But what's interesting, what does he do after he's converted? He visits Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is what to him? You're born in one place but raised somewhere else. It's like a hometown, right? And so he leaves Jerusalem very quickly after his conversion because Jesus asked him to leave because this is not a good place. Everybody knows your name here. And in this case, when you're Paul and you switch teams, you don't want to be in a place where everybody knows your name just yet, right? And so he had to leave. But he goes to Tarsus, surrounding region. Barnabas plays a big part in Paul's life, and we'll get to that later on. In the life of Paul, Barnabas plays a big part in him even being accepted by the Christians. So if you have one guy that's been persecuting the church, and all of a sudden he switches sides, and you're thinking, what? He's wanting to, you know, this is a CIA job kind of thing, right? And so it took Barnabas really to kind of help everybody convince him that, hey, no, he's on our team, I promise. So, he does, of course, mission work with Barnabas. And he does some missionary journeys with him as well, in Cyprus, in Galatia, and the council in Jerusalem. And Paul talks about his work with the Gentiles, and that's what he's called to do. And he's called his work is to work with the Gentiles. And we'll talk about, again, later on how he goes about doing that. But that is his primary work. And we see the second missionary journey, Asia Minor in Greece, and then go and visits Jerusalem once again in Antioch. He does a lot of his trips out of Antioch, begins his third missionary journey, stays in Ephesus. I'm putting stuff up there, or I haven't put stuff. I'm reading my notes, and you guys should see that, right? Travels throughout Greece. So he travels quite a bit, and we'll actually talk about that. So if you're traveling through an ancient civilization, let's just imagine you're traveling during this time period. What modes of transportation does Paul have for as far as travel? His feet. He probably used those once or twice. Ships, which he didn't always have the greatest luck with ships, and they were beasts of burden, obviously, right? So when we think about him traveling, and it's easy for us just to, and especially when we're reading the Bible gives us a Cliff Notes version of different events that are going on. And if they had given us, and Paul traveled, you know, X amount of miles, and on this day they woke up and their feet were still sore, the Bible doesn't give us that type of information. So when we're reading through it, it's easy for us just to, you know, skim over the fact that from verse 1 to verse 2, they were traveling to, you know, such and such a place. But we're talking about, like, months maybe of time between two verses when they're going from one place to the next, weeks and traveling from one place to the next. And so we'll kind of look at that, what kind of things as far as how was he traveling, what time does it take him to go from place to place, and really look into the, I guess, between the lines kind of information that you don't get necessarily when you're just kind of reading through the black and white in the text, which obviously the text is what we need to learn, but it's interesting how that kind of information brings it more to life. Right? It makes it more real when we can say, well, Paul went and traveled up to Ephesus. Well, did you know that traveling up there, he's walking uphill the whole way there. You know, he's probably in a little better shape than myself. And so, you know, it's so he's used to doing it, but it's when we start looking at this information that really brings the text and really shows what he's the work and the labor and the love that he had for those congregations. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. No, obviously not. No, that's not the most important. That's why the Bible gives us the important information. But it does kind of bring it to life for us and makes it more real, because we kind of gloss over it and put the, you know, the fast forward movie song. Y'all know movies when they play a certain song during a movie and like a thousand things get done and you're like, I want a soundtrack of just those songs. So I can get stuff done, right? So, you know, they gloss over a lot of information that we don't get to see. And so we see this with his timeline a little more. Again, we'll be getting into that later on in his life. But he goes back to Jerusalem, and what happens in Jerusalem? He gets arrested, and we'll talk. Everybody's telling him, if you go back, this is what's going to happen. And he needed to go back. And then this is where his Roman citizenship comes into play. And again, much later on, we'll talk about this, under house arrest and writing letters during that time. This is where there's some, he was possibly released and possibly went to Spain. And so, again, we'll look at the possibilities there. I'm just putting information up there. But if he did, then he returned and was martyred in 64-ish. So that gives us a lifespan of the life of Paul and helps us kind of see his life in a glance that way. But let's look at what he says about his life in Philippians chapter 3. If you'll open up your Bibles to Philippians chapter 3, he does mention some things about his life that it's best to look at what he says about it, right? Yeah. So Philippians chapter 3, beginning of verse 4. And in the context of this, you know, he was always dealing with people who were still trying to cling to the old law, the Torah, that which would had the traditions that they had been taught and raised to believe. And so he's constantly dealing with those type of individuals. Now, can you blame them? Have any of you ever said, I'm going to stop being American and I'm going to travel and I'm going to be a different culture altogether. I'm going to completely change. I'm changing my name. I'm changing the language I'm speaking. I'm changing the customs. I'm changing the special like holiday days. I'm changing all of that. I'm changing all of that. I'm renouncing whatever it was before. Have we done that before? Is that a huge change? Can you do that kind of change overnight?
No.
Not without, you know, unless you're Daniel, right? You don't do that kind of change overnight. And so when these people were transitioning into what it meant to be a Christian, a New Testament Christian out of Judaism, a lot of the things were no longer valid. A lot of things that they practiced their entire lives, their feast days, their special things, were no longer valid. The traditions, the things that they had done as a family were no longer, in the context of being righteous with God, were no longer valid. And so they're completely changing a lot of things. And so for them to hang on to these things that they have always been taught for hundreds and thousands of years, I can understand. If somebody just comes into town and says, well, you can stop doing this thing you've been doing for hundreds of years, it's going to be difficult. So Paul is constantly dealing with that. And in this text, he's doing the same kind of thing. And one of the things that they pride themselves on is this construct of being, I'm because I was born a Hebrew. You can't just, take a test and transfer into, I'm now a Hebrew national, I'm now a Jew, right? You can proselyte and you can pretend to be a Jew, but you can't really be a Jew of the lineage of Abraham if you were born in some Gentile nation. And so in this text, he talks about being aware of these people. And he says in verse 3, we'll start in verse 3, he's writing to the Philippian church, and so the we is whom? Who are we talking about? In verse 3. He's writing to the Philippian church. So the we is usans, right? Like us. So we, the members of the church, we are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ and put no confidence in the flesh. And so that's where this catch is. That's where the difference is. Although I myself might have confidence even in the flesh, if anyone else has mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more. And now he begins this list. What does he include in his list? What's the first thing he mentions in his list? If anybody has a right to be confident in the flesh about who they are and in their righteousness, Paul's saying, I'm a pedigree of individuals. I'm a thoroughbred as far as that's concerned. And what's the first thing he mentions? Yes, which we see in Leviticus. We see that as far as something that the Hebrew males were supposed to happen to them on the eighth day, and you can talk about it's interesting that they chose. Why was it interesting they chose the eighth, or they? God told them to do this on the eighth day. Why is that interesting, medically speaking? Yes, at that time the blood coagulates the fastest when. So it's interesting. Was that happenstance? Well, let's try it the first day. That didn't work out. Let's try it the second day. No, God told them this is when you're supposed to do it. All right, the next thing he mentions. What does he mention? Verse 5, circumcised the eighth day of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. What do we know about the tribe of Benjamin? It's a small tribe, exactly. It's there. It's where Jerusalem actually is in that area. Benjamin actually was one of the southern. It was right on the border. You're close. He was right on the border. And what's interesting is Saul was from there, right? It's the first king was from there. It's also a situation where, Judges 19 and 20 is sort of a dark period in their history. They almost got wiped out because of an indiscretion of a band of some of those Benjamites. The whole tribe of Benjamin came down to, what was it, 400 males were the only people left. And so that was a sort of a dark history. But they stayed with Judah. All right. And so that becomes a point where we never left, right? How many of you are fans of football teams that never really go very far, that consecutively over the years have never really done anything. Like when I was growing up, the Browns and the Bengals were not huge teams. We're not powerhouses. I was raised, I had no choice in this, a Dallas Cowboys fans. And we've had our dark ages as well. The 90s were awesome. I had all the trading cards during the 90s. And, you know, the long arm of the law, Troy Aikman. But we can talk about that later. But if you can say, I've been here the whole time. I've never left. I've been here the whole time. I've not been a fair weather fan. I've not gone off and, well, let's be on the Patriots team, you know, and I'll buy the Patriots jersey. And then next year you're buying somebody else's jersey. You say, I've been with God the whole time. We never left. We never went off in the north. We never were part of that apostate system that was set up. We never worshiped in Dan or in any other place. We were with God the whole time. We were not married in and mingled with all these other nations, like the tribes of the north were intermarried with other nations. We didn't do that. I am a Hebrew of Hebrews. And so when Paul talks about this, he's not saying, you know, this, well, that's nice, that's cute. This is what he's saying. So we've never left. We were here the whole time. And so, again, he's getting down to his pedigree. If this is what you're going to, to boast in, then this is what I'm going to show you. It also says, as to the law of Pharisee, and we kind of mentioned this earlier, but when you reread this, what does this mean, as to the law of Pharisee? What is he saying, do you think? What's that? It's a very strict form of interpretation. I think some of the Essenes may have been more strict. They're the desert guys, right? But in then you had the Sadducees, which were the left guys. They're the ones that, yeah, Greek culture, it's awesome. And they kind of tried to incorporate that. And so they were kind of looked down upon by those who are a little stricter. And so the Pharisees, what do we know about the Pharisees? Do they come up ever in the New Testament? Once or twice, right? Once or twice. Josephus, actually, this historian, ancient historian, writes about the Pharisees. He says in his book, The Antiquities, that they maintained a simple life, that, you know, that they were normal people. And okay, let me back up a little bit. When we look at the Pharisees and we just see them through the eyes of the New Testament and their interaction with Jesus and their interaction with the disciples and the apostles, we're seeing what of the Pharisee culture? We're seeing what? We're seeing like this much, right, of the Pharisee culture. Now, we can get the heart, maybe, and the construct, but are we seeing a broad spectrum representation of every Pharisee? Were there Pharisees who were not, like, in Jesus' face every day, fussing at him? If we looked at John chapter 3, would there be a Pharisee there that might have believed in Jesus? He came to Jesus at night because the Pharisees were very influential. Now, they were not a huge party, a huge faction, but they were very influential individuals. And so there was a certain Nicodemus who came to Jesus by night because why? In John chapter 3. Because he didn't want anybody else knowing. Because he also lived in the city where everybody knew his name. And he didn't want everybody knowing that he was talking to this radical Jesus guy. Right, this Jesus of Nazareth. And so again, yes, they did have people who were not necessarily all in Jesus' face all the time, but they believed, Josephus mentions that they believed both in fate and free will. They believed the immortality of both good and evil persons, and we'll talk about that shortly. And they are also considered the most accurate interpreters of the law. But when they interpreted, they also gave their own traditions connected with those interpretations. So they'd say, this is what it means, but we're gonna make sure that we are safeguarding ourselves about accidentally sinning and accidentally falling out of any kind of righteous relationship with God. So here's what the law says, and we're gonna build a hedge around this and even be more careful about not doing this. And they were kind of called those the separatists. They separated themselves from those who were unclean. They separated themselves from people who didn't teach and practice the same things they did. And so they were kind of seen as that group. They safeguarded themselves and make sure they were not doing anything. So they dictated their own oral traditions. And so when Paul was studying with Gamaliel, he was studying with Gamaliel, and Gamaliel was a very respected individual. And we see this in Acts chapter 4 and 5 when he's there with the Sanhedrin. He's a very respected individual. And so he's, again, one of the elites as far as who he studied with was even important. And that talks about the traditions that were handed down, the oral traditions that he was practicing. And so this all was something that was part of the Pharisaic teaching and culture. And so actually in the what does the King James say in relationship to this? Isn't it something as touching the law of Pharisee, right? And so this, and even the Pharisees wouldn't touch the Torah. They would read with this, I can't remember the name of it, this kind of pointer. It was like an early stylus kind of pointer, right? And they wouldn't actually even touch the law out of respect. So there's all these kind of things that they practiced and did that maybe others did not. And so the Pharisees, while they were in Jesus' face all the time, they were not everybody necessarily was. Look at Mark chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. What does Mark 7 say about... what does Mark 7, verses 3 and 4 say about the Philistine? Or the... did I say Philistines? The Pharisees. Did I say Philistines the whole time? Okay. That would be awkward. Okay. Mark chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. I'll let you read it to yourselves. What are they saying about the tradition of the Pharisees? What are they saying? They got to wash their hands. This is pre-antibacterial squirt bottle things, right? You got to wash your hands. But they didn't do what? They didn't do anything without washing. When they come from the market, they would wash because they might have touched something that was unclean. They might have touched something that an unclean person might have touched. And so they're washing their hands. They're washing. Is there anything wrong with that? Would you do that probably? Yeah. We practice this, right? With soap and sometimes brushy things. But in this case, they were binding this on other people. Is what they were doing in this context. They were binding something that was their own practice and their own hygienic practice. They would bind this on other people. And so again, this is something that they were doing.
Wouldn't it make more sense that if you bind something from a person and you don't really know that person, it makes sense for you to be careful because you don't know what kind of uncleanness.
Oh, yes. No, I'm not saying it's their own practice to do this thing, but they were fussing at the disciples because they didn't wash their hands like they were supposed to, air quotes, right? And so this gives us the background for that particular context. But again, this is one, like a snippet where the New Testament gives us some information about the Pharisees and what they practiced. Look in Luke chapter 13. This is interesting. Luke chapter 13. Verse 31. What does this say? Not necessarily about what the Pharisees taught, but what does this say about some of the Pharisees? Luke chapter 13, verse 31. What's that?
They were afraid of Herod.
They were afraid of Herod, but who were they warning? Jesus. What? They did that? So we have, when we think Pharisee, we think, red X, bad people, right? Were there some things said against them? We'll get to in a second. Yes. But were they all like horrible, foul, demonic people? No, that's not the case. And so this kind of, again, trying to give us a better idea of who we're talking about when we talk about the Pharisees. Did they do some things wrong? Yes, yes, they did. They ate with Jesus a lot of times just to test him. We see that happening in Luke chapter 7 and verse 14, and chapter 14. Some of them believed, as you mentioned, John chapter 3. And in Acts chapter, look at Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5. And this, I don't think necessarily is any type of, like they were trying to protect the disciples, more the providence of God and the wisdom of one individual in this case. In Acts chapter 5, verse 36, beginning of verse 33. But when they heard this, they were cut to the quick and intended to kill them, which happened, by the way, this cutting. In Acts chapter 2, what happened when they preached the gospel, Peter preached the gospel, and what happened to their hearts? They were cut to the heart, right? And here, this situation again, when the true, pure gospel is taught the way it's supposed to be taught, what should it affect? The heart. Now, when it affects the heart, what's the response? It's going to do something, right? And in some cases, Acts 2, that was great, it was awesome, right? And was for Stephen, not so good, right? Same kind of situation. And very similar to this, but here it says, but when they heard this, they were cut to the quick and intended to kill them, but a Pharisee named Gamaliel, where have I heard that before, Gamaliel? Paul's teacher, Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, respected by all people, stood up in the council and gave orders to put the men outside for a short time. And he said, the men of Israel, take care that what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined with him. But he was killed, and all those who followed with him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee, rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him. He too perished. All those who followed him were scattered. So in the present case, what is he presenting here? What is he presenting? What is Gamaliel saying? There was one guy who rose up, said he was something, and it came to nothing. There was another guy who rose up, said he was something, and it came to nothing. What is he presenting? We're trying to present a case here, right? Like if this, and this is what he begins to say in verse 38. So in the present case, I say to you, stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action is of men, it will be overthrown. It will come to nothing. But if it is God, what? You will not be able to overthrow them, or else you may be found fighting against God. What's interesting, we don't know, but wouldn't it be interesting if Paul was in the audience? Wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be interesting if Paul was in the audience hearing his teacher say this thing? If you're fighting against it, you may be fighting against whom? You may be found fighting against God. And so Gamaliel here in this situation says, just leave them alone. It's not wise in this case to start persecuting them and just chasing them down. You're wasting our resources, you're wasting our time, and I'm done talking about it, right? And so in this case, Gamaliel doesn't really save them, presents wisdom to the council for them to heed. And so again, just different perspective. But let's look over Matthew chapter 23. And we're not going to read the whole chapter of Matthew because we don't have that kind of time. But if you look at Matthew chapter 23, what do you see as you peruse this chapter? Anything stick out to you at all? Jesus is talking because it's in red, right? We know that. Just kidding. Jesus is talking. And what is he saying? Woe to you. Not like, whoa, how's it going? Woe to you. Like, this is bad stuff. And what does he call them? What are some things, what are some ways he used to describe them? Any examples here? Vipers. Anything else? Hypocrites. What's that? Blind guides. These would be good things or bad things? These are bad things. So Jesus, who sees into the souls of those individuals he's talking to, Jesus, who knows the thoughts and intents of the heart in this instance, says to them, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." And he pronounces these seven woes to them. Were they in error about what they were teaching? Yes. Were they in error about the spirit in which they taught it? Yes, they were. Was every Pharisee in error? Not necessarily. There were some who were intrepidly trying to come to Jesus, but still feared what the influence that others had. But again, they were doing some wrong things, obviously, in their life. And actually, if you look over at Matthew 15, verse 9. What did Jesus say here about them? Somebody almost quoted it there. So Jesus quotes this passage saying, "They're teaching as doctrine the precepts of men." Nothing to do with God, nothing to do with what they're supposed to. Look over in Titus chapter 1, verse 14. Kind of a foreshadowing of things to come. Titus chapter 1, verse 14. Who wrote the book of Titus? Paul did. What does he say in verse 14? It says, "Not paying attention to Jewish myths and commandments of men who turn away from the truth." So Paul obviously recognizes this, and we're going to, at this time, kind of look at his conversion. But again, he begins to be one proponent against that very line of logic, against that line of reasoning. So we're going to be looking at... I didn't actually get down to these, did I? All right. A law of Pharisee. As to zeal, what does he say is his example of zeal? What is his example of zeal?
Not according to knowledge.
Not according to knowledge, yes. That's Romans 10. We'll be talking about that later. Excellent. And when he talks about this example here, he says, I was so zealous, I was even going to Damascus, right, to persecute the church. That's how zealous I was. I was doing what I thought was right. And so, again, as to the righteous, which is in the law, found blameless. So he did all the things that he was supposed to do in the context of being a Pharisee. So again, that pedigree is what he's saying. That's a snippet of his former life that he gives to us. So we look at the conversion of Paul. We're going to be looking primarily at these two chapters, Acts chapter 9 and Acts chapter 22. And if you want to kind of put your fingers there and go back and forth between the two, I'll have my Bible open to Acts chapter 22. And so what are the two circumstances between the two chapters? Do you remember, as far as Acts chapter 9, we have Luke's account, right, of Luke telling us what happened, obviously inspired. And then Acts chapter 22, we have Paul giving a defense when he goes back to Jerusalem. He's giving a defense to the crowd about who he is, right? And what's interesting, in verse 2, so there's this huge mob who's already beating on Paul. And the Romans come down into this situation, try and make sure everybody's copacetic. Please understand that the Romans were trying to keep peace. Everything had to be peaceful, no fighting. They were like the big mom and dad kind of, everybody stop fighting, no fighting. I don't want to hear it. They were always trying to keep the peace, the Pax Romana, and because they did not want any uproars, any revolts. So that happened quite a bit. So they try to keep that peace. And so these commanders come rushing in there to stop what is going on and drag Paul out of there. And as he's being taken away, he turns around and begins to speak in the Hebrew dialect. In verse 2, and when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And then he begins to give this information about who he was, right? He says in the first few verses, "I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Sicily, Sicilia, brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you are all today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons. Also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify. From then I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. What is he saying to this crowd in this moment? What is he saying to them? Here's this crowd that's like wanting to beat on him because he is a follower of Jesus of Nazareth, this apostate individual trying to be the Son of God. And he is telling them what by giving this information to them? Speaking in their tongue. I used to be just like you, right? I used to be just like you. I was one of you. I don't know if you've ever heard inspirational speakers, ever. Anybody heard of inspirational speakers? Some of them don't make a lot of money, have to live in a van down by the river. But in this case, Paul is being sort of that inspirational speaker format in that I was just like you, right? You see, you hear the inspirational, but I did these things and I changed, and now I have bright, shiny teeth, and you know, I can wear skinny jeans and all these kind of things that the inspirational teachers talk about, right? And so in this situation, in this scenario, saying, I was just like you. I was just like you. What is he trying to make with these people? A connection, right? You know, there's a lot of thought about what goes into being a good teacher. Obviously, he's inspired. Obviously, you know, that kind of helps. And they were told not to be too careful, not to be worried about what they were going to say in the moment because the Holy Spirit would give them what they needed to say. But what he needed to say in that moment was, I was just like you, right? But then he goes on to tell what story is he telling us in this chapter? His conversion. We don't have time to go through every detail of his conversion, but he was going to Damascus, which, by the way, is over 100 miles to Damascus from Jerusalem, just in case you were wondering. It wasn't like two city blocks over. Never mind. To bring to prison and judgment those who were there, okay? So we've read this. Then he has this encounter with Jesus. What happened? Can y'all kind of tell me? You guys have the book open there in front of you. What happened in this scenario? Was he by himself? No, he had his cohort with him. And what happened? A bright light and a voice. What does the voice say? Why are you persecuting me? Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he says, who are you, Lord? And he says, I am Jesus the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. Was he physically persecuting Jesus? No, he wasn't. But was he persecuting the body of Christ? Yes, he was. And Jesus took that what? Personally. He took that personally. Which, what does that say about us in our relationship with Christ? It's personal. It's personal, right? We are a part of his body. Do you not think he knows when we are going through different situations? Yes. It's personal. And anyway. Ananias comes onto the scene, right? Ananias. And in the context, Ananias is like, God tells Ananias, hey, you need to go down to see the Saul of Tarsus on the road straight and talk to him. He's going to be on our side. And Ananias is like, what? Do you know this guy? Are you sure you've picked wisely in this scenario, because he's persecuting the church, and he says, I will show him the things that he must learn and suffer for my sake, all right? He's going to be going to the Gentiles. Ananias teaches Paul, as you look at this context, verse 12, a certain Ananias and a man was devout by the standard of the law, chapter 22, verse 12, and well spoken of by the Jews who lived there, came to me, standing near me, and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And about 13 days later, I finally kind of started to be able to see. And in that very moment, right, I looked up at him and he said, "The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth," which says something that we don't get to see this happen necessarily, but he's going to be instructed by the Christ, all right? This is what's going to happen. "For you will be a witness for him to all men that you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name." Get up, calling his name, have a great time, and when enough of you have gotten together, go down to the river and be baptized, because we do this once a month. It's not what the text says, right? It's not what the text says. So get up, be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on his name, because that's what this means. So we see this conversion, and Paul makes this team change, right? And Paul is baptized, and he goes back to Jerusalem, and then he leaves. And of course, he talks about how he was a witness to the stoning of Stephen, and so he went to Jerusalem, and Jesus tells him to leave, and this chapter tells us about that. And so he completely changed. His construct completely changed about Jesus the Christ. And what did he have to see? He had to see that Jesus of Nazareth was indeed Lord. He was not just some random guy saying he was all that in a bag of chips. He was the risen Lord, right? He had to see that. He had to see that we can be sincere but incorrect. We can be sincere and wrong at the same time, right? Just like maybe some of you are, "I am sincere in following as far as the Dallas Cowboys." Some of you are saying you are sincerely wrong in choosing that team. But in this case, you can be sincere and wrong at the same time. That our conscience, despite what a small cricket, animated cricket might say, your conscience may not be your best guide, right? Your conscience may not be your best guide. Even though there's a song about it, it may not be. Because if you've been raised up a certain way, believing a certain thing, for example, the Dallas Cowboys are the awesomest team on the planet ever, I could be wrong, right? That religion of our ancestry might be wrong. Did Paul had to make some change? Now, his religion wasn't what he transformed it into be was wrong. The Old Testament taught about the coming of the Christ and to bring about the Christ and to bring about what we have today. But his interpretation of that was wrong. And that in persecuting Christians, he was in fact fighting against the risen Lord and fighting against God. And so he had to see this in order for him to make the change. And there are people today who have to see the same thing in order to make the change. There are people who are still struggling with this very, very same construct, that maybe I am not making the right choices in my relationship with this Christ. Maybe I believe in him, but I don't believe it. I don't fully know who this Christ is. What's interesting, when they preached Christ, when Peter says, This Christ whom you crucified is both Lord and Savior. Not any other Jesus, this one. Because Jesus was a popular name. Right? It was like Josh at the time, right? So it was a popular name. And so this Christ. So there are a lot of people who need to learn the very same things in their relationship with Christ. And so in this class about the life of Paul, we're studying here obviously about his conversion and about how his life changed and his work. And so we're looking at his work and his travels and how that interacted with the culture of the time as well. Are there any other questions, comments, anything this morning? You or me are saved by the bell in that case, so I'll let you decide. Thank you for your time this morning.